The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
We're going to attempt to answer the question, just how will we know from an economic standpoint if Trump is actually making America great again? It's Bloomberg Benchmark, a podcast about the global economy. I'm Scott Landman, an economics editor with Bloomberg News in Washington, and I'm coming to you by myself again today because Dan and Kate were unable to join us. But fortunately, I have two esteemed colleagues with me today. Here in D.C. is Vince Gulley, a fellow editor who's been covering the U.S. economy for two decades. And up in New York, we have Carl Riccadonna, who's chief U.S. economist for Bloomberg Intelligence. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Glad to be here, Scott.
Now, often on Benchmark, we dig up unusual facts or indicators to make a broader point about trends in economies around the world. Today, we're going back to basics. It's our first show since Donald Trump took office as the 45th president of the United States. And since Benchmark is all about the economy and Trump has pledged to make America great again, we're going to attempt to answer the question, just how will we know from an economic standpoint if Trump is actually making America great again? Now, the president has dismissed some traditional measures of the U.S. economy, such as the main unemployment rate. He called that measure phony or fictional because he thinks it overestimates strength in the labor market. So we're going to run down some other economic indicators today. These are a bit more out of the mainstream, maybe a bit down in the weeds, but we think they'll show a good sense of the degree of the success of the Trump administration during the next 4 years. So obviously, we're not going to talk about unemployment or GDP, and instead we'll give you first two ways of looking at the labor market, then two ways of looking at the health of corporate America and small businesses, and also one gauge of whether Trump is fulfilling his pledge to bring factory jobs back to the U.S. So are you ready, guys?
Ready.
Let's go.
All right. So without further ado, here are the first two. The first is called prime age labor force participation. Now, translate into English from econo-speak, we can say that is people in the peak of their working years who have a job or are looking for one. And the second one would be full-time workers as a percentage of the labor force. That refers to people who have a full-time job as a share of everybody who has a job or is looking for work. Vince, let me go to you first. Why are these good gauges of both the economy and for Trump's goals?
Well, Scott, probably in the simplest terms, I'd say that it boils down to potential. People in this 25 to 54 age bracket working a full week have the best potential to gain work experience, secure better benefit packages like health care and 401k plans that allow them to prepare for retirement. And perhaps most importantly, they have greater earnings potential. And they have the ability to grow their earnings, earn more, which contrasts with, say, teenagers who are more likely to work for minimum wage. And the reason this is important is that these are the folks who are most likely to spend, and they'll probably spend big, whether it's buying a new car or house or what have you. The more potential to earn a good living will allow them to spend, and that in turn boosts the economy and encourages more hiring and more spending, and you get this sort of virtual circle for the economy.
Carl, what's been going on with prime age labor force participation in recent years, and why has it gotten criticism from Trump and his team?
Well, the participation rate goes through longer-term structural fluctuations. So it climbed from the late 1950s up until about 2000. This was partly a phenomenon of the baby boomers coming through the system, also women entering the workforce in increasingly large proportions. The time of 2000, the participation rate peaked and began to decline. At the time of the 2007 to 2009 recession, the Great Recession, it actually accelerated the pace of decline. And so the question is, how much of this is really due to long-term structural trends in the economy? If we think of the baby boomers going through the system like that python that swallowed an egg or some large object. So part of that is just an inevitable trend. But the question is this acceleration since the end of the Great Recession. And a lot of economists are wringing their hands saying there's no way to forecast labor participation and whatnot. And I think that if we take a step back and take a very straightforward, common sense approach, there is a way to actually model that out, at least to some degree. And we can do that by looking at economic conditions, or getting back to the prior comment, the prospects of earning a good living. The health of the economy and strength of the economy impacts how much workers are moving off of the sidelines and into the economy. So over the past 7, 10 years, economic conditions have not been great. Wage stagnation has been a big problem, and job prospects have not been particularly strong. And this means that a lot of would-be workers have remained on the sidelines, and that has taken a toll on participation. Now, what Janet Yellen, chair of the Federal Reserve, and some other economists also on the Open Markets Committee want to do is explore the potential of pursuing a high-pressure economy, as she terms it, or as New York Fed President Bill Dudley mentions, letting the economy run a bit hot. And what they mean by this is by letting the economy exceed its growth rate and being slow to push back with monetary policy or interest rate policy, they can actually lead to a pickup in inflation and wage pressures, and that will coax folks off of the sidelines and possibly bend the trend in terms of declining labor force participation. Now, this is not something they completely can fix, but at the margin they can influence it.
Now, how do you square the ability to get people off the sidelines, say, if the Fed supports accommodative policy, or if Trump enacts fiscal stimulus, with the idea that I've read these articles about some of the reasons why you have such a downturn in prime age participation is because maybe the prevalence of drugs, people on pain medication, men in their 20s and 30s playing too many video games. Is an improving economy enough to reverse trends that are maybe more baked into the economy at this point?
I think an improving economy is a critical part of the picture. Now, opioid addiction and a lot of other factors certainly do extend a toll. But if you're, let's say, for example, you're sitting on your couch playing video games or watching movies and collecting maybe an unemployment check or maybe a welfare check or a disability payment, and suddenly you see your neighbor across the street is buying a new car or renovating their home or taking a nice vacation, that type of, for lack of a better term, envy coaxes people to say, well, the welfare check is good enough, but I'd like to do a little bit better, and I'm willing to re-enter the labor force. So, in some sense, there are people that will not be able to re-enter. But in a lot of instances, for example, in a dual-income household, one parent may be choosing to stay home to oversee childcare rather than take a job that barely pays for the cost of sending their children elsewhere for child care.
Now let's talk about the other indicator I was discussing, the share of full-time workers out of the labor force. You can talk all you want about an improving economy, getting people off the sidelines and into the labor force, but if those jobs are not the kinds of full-time, good-paying jobs that Vince was talking about, one criticism we've heard from Trump and also a lot of other economists about the economy in recent years is that a lot of jobs that have been created are actually either part-time in services and low-paid, or they're in the gig economy with the rise of such services as Uber, as we're all well aware. What's going on with the state of full-time and part-time work? Are there a lot of people, Vince, who are working part-time who would rather have full-time jobs?
Well, we have seen some of the people that are working part-time that want a full-time job. We have that seen that start to reverse here lately. So I think there is some improvement there. A lot of this too, you could probably attribute to a service economy, and some people just want to work part time and not worry about having a work full time position. I know that President Trump has mentioned the cost of child care needing to come down, and a lot of housewives, if you will, are choosing to stay home rather than go seek full-time employment.
Carl, how do you see this playing out? Are we going to see more people getting full-time jobs, or is the trend toward more part-time work, something that's just a fact of life now?
Well, I think we have two trends moving in opposite directions with the advent of the gig economy and TaskRabbit and Uber and all these sorts of things. The availability of part-time work becomes significantly elevated, so that will be a longer-term trend. But what we watch more closely as economists is part-time work for economic reasons. So this is not someone who's driving Uber on the weekend for a little extra cash, but these are workers who can only find part-time employment, although they would prefer full-time employment. And if we watch that trend, and this is something, again, that Chair Yellen has referenced at the Fed, this is moving in the right direction, but not fully normalized. So in a very odd sense, Chair Yellen and President Trump are on the same page in questioning the signal from the national unemployment rate. Chair Yellen, long before President Trump was criticizing the unemployment rate, was making the same point, saying that is an incomplete measure of conditions in the labor market. And so instead, she looked to these other broader measures, one of which was part-time workers for economic reasons.
Yeah, Janet and Donald are probably going to find some common ground the next time, when they actually have their first meeting together, despite Mr. Trump's criticism of her during the campaign. Let's move on to another indicator. This one doesn't need much deciphering. It's the number of manufacturing workers on payrolls in the economy. A lot of Trump's campaign was about how NAFTA and China have killed all these jobs over the last 20 years and how he would restore them. Carl, what are the chances that this is going to happen?
Well, some of the jobs are gone and certainly are not coming back. We are moving, in an increasingly automated assembly lines. I've been reading recently about some assembly lines where they don't even turn the overhead lights on until something needs a repair, because there are basically only robots who are happy to work in the dark on those assembly lines. So, to some degree, a lot of the manufacturing jobs that you imagine your father or grandfather working at are probably not coming back. However, if we are sourcing more production in U.S. factories, there will be an impact on manufacturing jobs. So some jobs will come back. And the general rule of thumb is that for every one manufacturing job, there's about three service sector jobs that support it, whether it's engineering, design, transportation, finance, etc. So even if we bring back some manufacturing jobs, that will have a very powerful impact. Now, I hear time and time again, well, the jobs aren't coming back, so what's the point in pursuing it? There are tremendous economic benefits to manufacturing activity happening on U.S. soil. So, yes, there's a question mark over how many jobs will actually come back, but innovation happens on the shop room floor. And so if the vehicles and widgets are being assembled on U.S. soil, then the engineers and the design folks and all of that other higher level sophisticated work tends to happen in close proximity to the factory. So when the factory moves overseas, it's not long until the engineering, design, and management jobs tend to follow. And so there's an intangible benefit, much more comprehensive than just the actual job count from sourcing production back on U.S. soil.
So we're at just over 12 million manufacturing jobs right now. You don't really see that moving a whole lot, but it could go up. What are you thinking?
I think it could trend higher depending how aggressively President Trump pursues the initiative of sourcing production. And, you know, we're only a few days into the new administration, but based on the tone of the inaugural address and some of the measures he has emphasized early on, whether it's, restrictions on manufacturers from re-importing partially manufactured goods to trying to pressure pipeline construction to use U.S. Manufactured materials where possible. It seems like it's going to be a very high priority item for the new administration. And mind you, what we've seen just in these first couple days are already likely the beginnings of the re-election campaign for 2020. President Trump's path to the White House largely went through the Rust Belt, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. And if he wants to return to the White House in 2020, he's going to have to perform well in those states. And those disenfranchised workers who feel like they've been roadkill on the path to globalization have to feel that they have gotten some kind of benefit out of this administration.
All right. Well, let's move on to a broader indicator of corporate America and American business. That would be capital spending. Vince, when we talk about capital spending, what does that refer to and what's been happening with that in the last few years?
It's basically spending by companies on like plants and buildings and equipment, machinery. And from the last part of 2014 through this last year's third quarter, it's been averaging basically a paltry 0.2% on average. Now, part of this is owed to the slowdown in the oil patch, but not all of it. And on the flip side, when the energy industry was spending hand over fist at the start of the recovery, investment was spending pretty nicely. Now, as for small businesses, it's a little difficult to measure, but the National Federation of Independent Business data show that until recently, optimism has been fairly tepid, certainly well below the levels leading up to the last recession. And part of that is due to the subdued economic recovery and a good deal of it can probably be attributed to government policies, from Obamacare to government regulation. They've actually mentioned that in the surveys that the NFIB does. More recently, however, the gauge, the NFIB's gauge of optimism has shot up in this last report, but actually by the most since 1980. Now, small businesses are liking what they hear from the Trump administration. They just want less government intrusion and a clear path to doing business.
So obviously it hasn't it's been kind of seen kind of paltry gains in recent years, but optimism is picking up. Carl, is that going to be enough to translate into higher spending that actually boosts GDP?
Well, the jury is still out on that question. So absolutely, animal spirits are a critical element of a capitalist system. So if everyone's feeling depressed and salting away their paychecks into savings, that can have dire economic consequences. Since Election Day, we've seen a significant rise in household sentiment, home builder sentiment, small business sentiment, even other broader measures of economic sentiment like the stock market, for example. However, we haven't seen much hard data yet to support that, and that's because economic data is released with a lag. That being said, you know, vehicle sales were strong at the end of December. Retail activity seemed to end the year on relatively solid footing. So there seems to be some evidence that positive sentiment is actually impacting the economy. But again, it's still very much in the early stages.
Let me give you a term, net business births. It sounds kind of odd, but it's just another way of saying the number of businesses that are created in a period minus the number that close. It's another indicator about of the health of the economy, you know, as we can look at it under President Trump. Vince, why did we pick this one and what's been happening with that lately?
Well, simply because, you know, new businesses are basically the lifeblood of the economy. I mean, you have a new business created. They're successful, they hire, they get even more successful, the more hiring they'll do. After the recession ended in 2009, it wasn't until a year later that business births actually exceeded the number of, you know, firms that went out of business. Currently, net births are about where they were during the last expansion, but they're well below the peak that we had in 2005. So I think that a pickup in you know, company formation will likely depend on how successful, you know, Trump and Congress are in making it easier for entrepreneurs to do business.
Carl, how important would this be to drive the economy?
Oh, it's absolutely critical. So business births tend to be among small and medium-sized businesses, which account for the vast majority of jobs in the private sector. I think roughly 85% are attributed to firms of 500 employees or less. You know, business births and also business investment, so two themes that Vince was hitting on, both tend to be late cycle components of the economy. So early on in cycles, we tend to see growth driven by things like consumer spending and housing. And then later on in the cycle, with the economy continuing to grow, businesses start to face capacity constraints. And so they invest in the equipment and software and structures that Vince was highlighting. That also tends to be the stage where we see more formation of businesses as folks are more confident in the overall economic outlook. So the fact that we're seeing both of those measures kind of only normalizing now or starting to pick up may be some clues that this cycle is going to be unique in that it is going to be much longer than the typical post-World War II or even in the modern era business cycle in, let's say, 1980 to present, if we can call that the modern era. So in Fed terms, that's Volcker, Greenspan, Bernanke, and Yellen. Business cycles have averaged about 32 quarters. We're in the 31st quarter of the current cycle. So by that measure, you would say, wow, the next recession can't be too far off. But when we start to look at underlying fundamentals, like what's driving the economy or where are the late cycle indicators, have they engaged yet? They're not really there. And so this economy is not as long in the tooth as a pure calendar-based measurement would otherwise suggest.
So, Carl, taking a big step back and thinking about what you just said there and what we've been talking about, what are the chances that President Trump can fulfill his promises to make America great again in the next 4 years?
Well, this is going to be an economist answer, but it really depends on how you want to measure that. So will GDP growth be stronger? I know you said we can't talk about GDP at the start, but if we are, financing significant tax cuts and infrastructure spending by borrowing more, then that is a cheap sugar high that can elevate economic growth until it comes around to actually paying the bill. So, there could be a short to medium term acceleration in the pace of growth purely for that reason. The unemployment rate, I'm going to break all the rules. You said we can't talk about unemployment. The unemployment rate is, running below its natural level. And so we're starting to see increasing evidence of shortages of workers, which will mean workers have greater bargaining power and more wage pressure and wage creation as a result. So from that perspective, it's also going to look better. Part of the economy or the country feeling greater is just the inevitable result of stretching on and prolonging the recovery from a very severe economic downturn. On top of that, then the icing on the cake will be things like trade policy, which could favor the Rust Belt states, and tax cuts, which could help certain sectors of the economy. So in some context, yes, I don't see a recession coming for quite some time. So the tone and temperament of the economy will feel significantly better in the next several years, in some part due to the new administration and some part just due to where we stand in the cycle.
All right, Carl, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Vince, thank you for joining us too. For more on this, you can actually call up a graphic we put together that you can find on Bloomberg.com called How We'll Know If Trump Is Making America Great Again. And Benchmark will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal and Bloomberg.com, our newly revamped Bloomberg app, as well as on iTunes, Pocket Casts, and Stitcher. While you're there, please rate and review the show so more listeners can find us, and let us know what you thought of the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Scott Landman. Carl, you are at
Reconomics, RICCANOMIX.
And Vince, you are at
Double, spelled out, T, Goalie, in support of my alma mater, Texas Tech University.
All right. Benchmark is produced by Sarah Patterson. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Alec McCabe. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.